You are listening to the World of Higher Education podcast, Season 2, Episode 25.
Hello, everyone. I'm Alex Usher, and this is the World of Higher Education podcast. On February 24th, 2022, the Russian Federation launched an unprovoked, full-scale invasion of its neighbor, Ukraine. In an instant, the entire country became a battlefield. We all remember the names of the cities and towns that came under attack in those early months of the war. Irpin, Bucha, Kharkiv, Kherson, and more than anywhere else, Mariupol. 26 months ago, Mariupol was a town of 425,000 people. Historically, it was a city with a peaceful mix of Russian and Ukrainian-speaking citizens, with just a dash of Greek speakers as well, a reminder of the city's history as a center for Greek immigration in the 18th century. Located on the Sea of Azov, it was perilously close to what had become the front line between Ukraine and the puppet breakaway Donbass People's Republic. That put it right in the path of the invasion. Perhaps because of this long proximity to violence, many residents of Mariupol did not believe the violence would enter the city itself. They stayed. By the 26th of February, the Russian army had the city surrounded. The siege which followed lasted 2.5 months and cost the lives of tens of thousands of soldiers and civilians. By May, the city was flattened, a ruin, and most of its inhabitants had become refugees. And not just its inhabitants. In some cases, entire institutions went on the run as well. Today, I'll be talking to Dr. Mykola Trofimenko, the president of Mariupol State University. He agreed to join the show to talk to us about the events of early 2022, how he steered the institution through the siege and after it, and how the institution, now known as the Invincible University, came to gain a new home in Kyiv. It's a harrowing story, but also an inspiring one, one that gets to the heart of the question, what makes a university? Bricks and mortar or people? It's an incredible tale, but I can't do it justice. Let's listen to Mykola. Dr. Trofimenko, tell us about Mariupol State University. I understand it's a fairly new university created in the 1990s and one which focused mainly on social sciences and humanities. Tell us about the university prior to 2020. What was it good at? What were its strengths?
Actually, it was founded in 1991, exactly in the same time, exactly after the independence of Ukraine was proclaimed. And actually, this university had a huge task because it was founded in the eastern Ukraine and it was modern. It was some kind of the result of democratic changes and of national movements. We had a huge Greek diaspora and we have it actually in southeast Ukraine with more than 100,000 Ukrainian Greeks with their dialects. And Mariupol was founded by Greeks. But during the Soviet time, all this national education and culture studies, they were prohibited. And this university was, one of the core aims was to humanitize very much industrial region of Ukraine, because it was in Donetsk region with a coal mines, with a industry, heavy industry, with a traditional, very technical background. One of the main tasks was to humanitize and to raise the new generation of Ukrainian citizens, because we are facing until now actually these problems, because these regions, they were not very much integrated. They had no common actually spirit of Ukraine, but due to the university, and actually we raised thousands of graduates who were in the Ukrainian context, and actually they are very much great Ukrainian citizens that we are very much proud of.
So a nationalizing effort of Ukrainian-speaking Ukrainians, Russian-speaking Ukrainians, Greek-speaking Ukrainians, but an integrative nationalist project in effect. So you became rector, I think, in 2020, so 30 years after the university was formed. When you put your name forward, what did you imagine you would be doing as rector? What were your main priorities?
This university, it was my life, because I entered this university in 2002 and I graduated from it in 2006 as a bachelor, in 2008 as a master. And I was a very active student. I was the first head of the Students' Council of the university. After I was invited to become a head of International Relations Office of the university, because I graduated from International Relations from this university. After I worked for 4 years as a head of the International Relations Office, I defended my thesis for PhD in 2011, and I became vice rector. I worked for 9 years, and after, when our previous rector, he decided to stop, actually, and actually it was his term to stop. It was his second term of rector. I actually decided to run for this position, and I won with a 90%, I think. And I became actually the youngest rector of Ukraine ever. Of course, I wanted to make my university very unique and a strong center for education, for culture, for development, for international cooperation, for internationalization, and to make it very much important for community, for the region, and to be very much influential, to prepare very good students, to make this organization very much effective. And I think we've done a lot, and we're still actually on this way, if we can say. When I came into the office, we faced the coronavirus. After that, actually the full-scale invasion. So challenging, but the fate is preparing us for something great. That's why we believe that now we are building up something, a very much new university with a new philosophy, with a new meanings, actually. And I think we are on the right way.
So let's go back to February 2022. It's now late March 2024, so 25 months ago. In the weeks before the invasion, it must have been clear at the time that if war came, Mariupol would be in the front line, as it was to some extent in 2014. What kinds of contingency planning were you doing in those last few weeks before war came? Could you conceive at that point of being a university in exile?
We were living in the front line from 2014. And Mariupol was very much close to the real war, actually, with the shellings, with all these, with the soldiers, with everything. And we were living with this from 2014. And of course, we understood that if something will start, that we will be again on the front line. But we actually didn't expect that something cruel of this scale will happen, that someone can order to destroy 500,000 people's inhabitant city. It was unbelievable. Of course, we were. I didn't expect that we will be in exile, because our regiment Azov, for example, or our armed forces who were protecting Mariupol, they were very much prepared, and they knew actually how to fight from 2014. They had a lot of possibilities to train, actually, with weapons, and they were prepared with their positions, very much prepared again. The problem was that we were taken under the siege so quickly, and we didn't have so many powers or forces to protect from the circle. I'm also the member of the city council. On February 22nd, we called the meeting of the city council, where we analyzed the situation, our situation with the shelters, with some political ideas. But actually, the official authorities, they were convinced that we shouldn't expect something very much dangerous. We shouldn't evacuate people, because all our evacuation trains, they will leave in Mariupol empty, almost empty. And actually, I was also actually believing all this. Of course, we were trying to show that we are very much calm and prepared, and that we don't afraid. But we were preparing as a university. We analyzed what we can evacuate if something will happen. And I held a meeting of our heads of departments, and I've told them very calmly not to start panic, actually, to think what can we take with us if something will happen, and if probably we should run the university from another place. And actually, with these thoughts, we left home.
So when did that actually happen? Because Mariupol was surrounded, was cut off from the rest of Ukraine very early in the war, by about the 26th of February, if I understand. So when was the actual decision taken? That must have been a snap decision, and a lot of things would have had to fall into place very quickly. So when was the date when the actual decision was made?
Actually, I celebrated the 5 years of my son on February 23rd. And early in the morning of 24th, we heard actually the hittings and all these shellings of Mariupol. And we turned on the internet and TV. We heard some lecture from Crazy Putin about the history of Ukraine and who founded Ukraine and what they want to do. And actually, I went to the university. We met with my vice rectors, heads of departments, and immediately we decided to load our minibus with the servers, computer servers of the university. They were prepared, actually. We prepared some new equipment. We had about 30 laptops or 15 computers, some very much important documents from HR documents. And I've sent this minibus to Dnipro. And actually, I signed officially the order to evacuate all the important, the university to Dnipro. Actually, this is a historic document.
Yeah. And this is on the 24th.
On February 24th. Yeah. I signed this order to evacuate the university. I ordered to all representatives, to all the heads of departments, to prepare all the important documents and necessary vital, actually, stuff, and to evacuate everything to Dnipro. And after that, we continued together all the important, as we thought, actually, documents and from archive, for example, the students' books with the signatures when they received their diplomas from the foundation of the university. Actually, it was the right decision because now we can give this corpus of diplomas to these people when they refer to the university. And actually, it's hundreds of people because a lot of them, they've lost their diplomas in the fires of Mariupol. And actually, we continued. We went to Dnipro with my chief accountant and left everything there, hidden in the right place. And we decided to come back on 26th. Because actually I wasn't feeling good because I was in Dnipro and my 5,000 students and 400 employees and faculty members, they were in Mariupol under the siege with hundreds, thousands of inhabitants. As a member of the city council, as a rector, actually it wasn't right. That's why we decided to come back. Actually, the only mistake I've made was to take my wife with my son with me, because my wife she took me actually on the throat and she told me that she will not let me go and that we should go together. It was a mistake actually, because my son, he has seen the things that I as a grown up want to very much to forget. And that's why, but actually it was a decision to make.
So you've made a good point here, which is that part of a university is embodied in its books, in its documents, in its servers, but a university is also really its people. So when you left and you said, look, we're going to keep this university going, we're going to make sure that it's safe, we're going to put it in Dnipropetrovsk, what was the reaction of your staff? Did they come, like how many came out with you?
After I came back on 26th, I made a video. And I published it on Facebook next to the building of the university with the inscription Mariupol State University for my people, actually, to show them that I'm in the city, that I'm with them. It was heartbreaking because it was so much important to the university community and for the Mariupol residents, actually, to feel that you didn't actually let them, you didn't leave them. And because our mayor, for example, he decided to leave and he didn't come back to Mariupol. So in this sense, we had the, after 26, the electricity, gas, water supplies, there were all these pipes and everything, they were hit by the shellings, and we didn't have electricity and water and gas supplies, and we had no connection. It was the main problem. And we had the first chance to leave on March 15. And after that, when I visited actually the meeting of in Mariupol City Council, where the representative of International Red Cross Organization, he announced that they will try to find a way out of Mariupol because the city was closed. Actually, it was difficult because we didn't see the soldiers of Russia because they shelled constantly without any pauses and they destroyed everything. And in this hell, people tried to prepare food and to find the water or something else, or fight the fires in the buildings that were hit. And International Red Cross Organization announced that they will find this way. And we decided to go. And we tried to inform as many people as we can. Actually, we were very much lucky because there were no connection for the Russians also. So they couldn't check your identity. And it was actually very much good for us because with my pro-Ukrainian position of the member of the city council and rector, they tried to gather all the members of the city council to legitimize actually their authorities. We started the Telegram channel where we put all the contacts we had with my vice rectors or with the people who were in Ukrainian-controlled territory. And we started to gather information, what problems people had with the places in the cars, with the gas, the some other problems we tried to solve. For example, we had a lot of wounded colleagues with their relatives. We tried to help them to be evacuated in Donetsk, to send them some money for them to receive some healing and to pay for the journey from occupied Donetsk, for example, through Baltic states, Poland, in Kyiv. And we had only several weeks to think where to go. But we were confident, actually, that we want to restart. You said very much correctly that, and actually this is our core of our actions during the last 2 years, that the university is not the walls at all. And we checked it very much toughly on our example. It's people. And with these people, you can rebuild and build up everything you want. The new walls, the new premises, laboratories. Actually, what we are doing in Kyiv now, because we are building up a new university with a new philosophy, with a new senses, actually. And we have 90% of our staff that decided to be with us. 90% of faculty, of staff, and of the students, actually.
Okay, we're going to take a short break. We'll be right back.
This podcast is brought to you by Higher Education Strategy Associates, a sector-specific consultancy based in Toronto, Canada. Generative artificial intelligence has taken the higher education sector by storm since the release of ChatGPT at the end of 2022. Since then, many post-secondary institutions have been working to develop their response to this new technology. At HESA, we've developed a database of institutional policies, statements, and guidelines that are being developed across the country and all around the world. Need an extra hand with developing your own institutional response to Gen AI? We can help. Reach out to our team to discuss ways in which we could support your efforts.
And we're back. It's mid-March, you've left Mariupol, and I guess you have a choice at this point whether to locate in Dnipropetrovsk or in Kyiv. You have a choice to be an in-person institution or an online institution. How do you, because I know you are in Kyiv now and you share a campus, I think, with the Kyiv Civil Engineering Institute. How do you split your activities these days between online and in-person? What is the new model for the university?
This was much, much more wiser. We had the propositions and ideas to go to Kamianets-Podilsky, to Rivne, to a lot of places. But we decided, actually, after what Mariupol faced and what our university community actually faced, we decided to be as much useful as we can to our Ukraine, actually. In this sense, Kyiv, the capital of our country, we consider it very much appropriate because here we can help and we can fight in this hybrid war, actually, because it's running not only in the front line physically, it's running very much strongly and sometimes stronger than on the front line in the sense of information and education. In this sense, university is very much helpful. In Kyiv, we received the building from our friends and colleagues that I will be very grateful for them and to them, to the rector of this University of Construction and Architecture, Petro Kulikov. He's the head of the Union of Rectors of Ukraine. I'm his deputy, actually, in this union. And he invited us because he understood how important Mariupol University is in in different senses, in the sense of consider the tragedy of the people, because we had 18 killed colleagues and students. We have 250 students and colleagues. The fate of them is unknown. We have a lot of students that are in captivity now. We have a lot of tragedies, actually. But in this sense, he decided to help us, and he gave us the building of 4,000 square meters, and we are rebuilding it now with the help of the European Union. We hosted during this actually short period the Vice President of the European Commission, the President of Ukraine, Volodymyr Zelensky. He visited us actually in November, and we're trying to create this modern, very much comfortable educational space for our faculty, students, and staff, and for the community, because we decided to become civic university, to be the core, the magnet for all the residents. Because now Mariupol lives in the university, and we are actually very much responsible for the identity and for the people, to help them, because we have a humanitarian hub, and we are doing a lot, much more than usual university do, actually, usually.
How do you keep the whole enterprise afloat financially? You still have to cover your costs. You've got lots of employees, but your fee revenue must be down. I imagine you're teaching fewer students than you were 2 years ago. And I imagine government subsidies must be lower because of the cost of carrying on heavy military operations. What's your budget compared to what it used to be? What do you have to do without now that you didn't 2 years ago?
What I've done right as a rector, and I understand it now, actually. During the first year of my office, I reduced and I optimized actually all the operational expenses of the university. And we made it the budget very much effective. And of course, we use all the window of opportunities we have. And we participate in different projects. We fundraise. We try to organize and to have new partnerships with the different institutions, physical, with the persons, with the officials, to start new partnerships, new programs, and to receive some resources for the development of the university and for its actually existence. The resources, not only money, actually, but equipment, people, possibilities, mobilities, some international programs for our staff and students. For example, I will tell you the numbers. In my contract as a rector with the Minister of Education, I have key performance indicators. And one of them is to try to earn for the special fund of the university during the, for example, 2023, 500,000 hryvnias plus, if to compare with the date when I was appointed. So the special fund in 2020 plus 500,000 in 2023. We earned not 500,000, but 53 millions, 5,000% plus. So I think we are doing our job very much effectively now.
So what does the immediate future look like for the university? Can it continue in this form indefinitely in exile? I mean, you made the point earlier that this is it's a symbol of Mariupol. It has to endure. It's got so much civic pride attached to it. But on the other hand, the longer you stay in Kyiv, I imagine the longer you become, your students and your employees become part of your new home as well. If Mariupol does not return to Ukrainian control, say in 5 years, will you still be Mariupol State University or will you be something else?
I think it's our obligation to preserve the university. And we are trying, I didn't mention that we are trying to restart our educational process in the hybrid format, combining online and offline. Because we have a lot of problems, a lot of people spread all over Ukraine and Europe. And it's a very much weak issue, because if you will tell them, you should come back to Kyiv because we are starting offline. But to say, to give these orders or to ask them to do this, you have to prepare some housing for them. And of course, we can't do it immediately for everyone. We are repairing, reconstructing dormitory for staff and students to give them opportunities, because all Mariupol residents, they've lost everything. And we should help them in this sense. In this, we are trying to be very much flexible. If, for example, you will give, you will ask your students from Europe to come back to Ukraine to study offline, we can lose them because they will continue their studies in Europe. In this sense, Ukraine will lose the most precious we have, our young people, because we need them very much in Ukraine to rebuild and to build up the new country, the educational spaces for community, because it's important to give possibility to the inhabitants of Mariupol to come to the walls of the university and to feel themselves like home. Because these people, when you've lost your home, actually, it's important to have this feeling mentally, not to get crazy, actually, and to feel yourself among the people who are natives, who are very much, you know them, actually. And yeah. We received another gift from the ministry, from the government of Ukraine. We received 4 hectares and 13,000 square meters that very shortly will become the property of my university in Kyiv. And we are designing the visualization, the visual project of the campus of the future. Because the tragedy of Mariupol University gave us possibility to think about what and how university should look like. What should it have? For example, it's difficult to the universities that are 100 years and, for example, they have everything very much traditional, actually. For us, it's possibility to build and to look forward. And I think this is actually the name for this campus that was, it's the idea of the president of Ukraine. He named it during his visit to the university in November last year. Invincible campus of Invincible University. And this campus will become the center, not only for the university community, but for the Mariupol and regional Donetsk region IDPs, for veterans, for the soldiers, for the different courses, for all the issues that are actually for this issue that are in the sphere of our responsibility. And I think Mariupol University will exist even after 4, 6, 7, 10 years. We know, we understand that Mariupol will come back to Ukraine, and we should be ready. And in this sense, politically, and not only politically, but we want to prepare, and we are now with a lot of companies and businesses thinking, running the programs to prepare specialists for the reconstruction of Ukraine and to govern and to manage the deoccupied territories. It's very much important. In this sense, we will exist. And it's our responsibility to preserve the identity. Actually, if we will succeed, but I think we will continue our development and the university will live.
But I understand that another university has started up in Mariupol in the last few months, obviously under the control of occupation authorities. And when Mariupol returns to Ukrainian control, if the front line falls tomorrow and Mariupol returns to Ukraine and you're able to go back, what do you think would happen? Would it be possible for staff of the two universities to work again in a new merged institution or not?
It's a very difficult issue. I can answer emotionally. I can answer as a, I don't know, rector that understands politics. Yeah, but in the sense of reconciliation and something that's where we can say. But in our case, Mariupol University, the so-called Mariupol University in Mariupol, you understand that Russian FSB, what does it mean? They work very much professionally and are creating in Mariupol propaganda pictures, because it's impossible to rebuild 5, 10, 20 buildings in Mariupol where you destroyed everything and killed 120,000 people. And you have 200,000 people that fled Mariupol. You have only 100,000 with a lot of representatives from the Central Asia that are spending money of the Russian budget by reconstructing something. It's a huge cemetery, because I'm witness actually of the mass graves, of the scary pictures actually. And it's difficult for, I don't know if, because we are now telling that we will rebuild Mariupol and people will come back. I don't know if they will come back, because, for example, I understand my responsibility, but I don't know if I want my son to come back there as a father, actually, because it's a cemetery. And in this sense, we are lucky to have only several traitors. They are traitors. They are not the people who tried to survive or who had some circumstances, personal circumstances that didn't let them to leave. They're traitors, because they are now raising the young generation of the students, telling them that Ukraine was shelling Mariupol and it was taken by Ukrainian troops under the siege. It's something crazy, something you can't imagine how it's possible to tell this. It's the narrative of security, Federal Security Bureau. They are working professionally to keep young people in Mariupol, because they are still there. Russians, they are acting as an imperial state, as they actually acted during the emperor times when they created colonies. In this sense, they trying to keep these young people in Mariupol and to attract another young people from regions of Russia by giving scholarships for the first year of studies in these so-called universities. They gave some hundreds, I don't know, 600 or 700 or 900 scholarships. These people are coming. They are making, I don't know, girls and boys, they are making families, and they are putting their roots in these territories, and they can call it Russian for 100%. So they are doing it for centuries, actually. It's nothing new in Mariupol, but professionally, using all the opportunities, because I met a lot of our graduates and alumni that came from the captivity. I know how many proposals our graduates received to become rectors of this university, because they need support of their brainwashing. They are realizing every day from the TV. If when Ukraine will liberate Mariupol, I don't think that when we will come to Mariupol, we will meet the colleagues, because they understand what they've done and they will leave. We will not meet them.
Mykola Trofimenko, thank you so much for your time today. It just remains for me to thank our excellent producers, Tiffany McClellan and Sam Pufik, and you, the listener, for tuning in. If you have any questions about this episode or suggestions for future ones, please don't hesitate to get in touch at podcast@higheredstrategy.com. Join us next week when our guest will be N.V. Varghese. He's the Vice Chancellor at the National Institute of Educational Planning and Administration in New Delhi, and he'll be joining to talk about his new co-edited book on private higher education in India. Talk to you then.
The World of Higher Education podcast is a Higher Education Strategy Associates production, produced by Tiffany McLennan and Samantha Pufek, hosted by Alex Usher, music by T. Bless and the Professionals. Thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app.